Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, Anne-Marie Slaughter has had an extensive career as an academic and lawyer. She was the first female director of policy planning at the State Department and is now the president of the New America Foundation and a professor of politics and international affairs at Princeton University. She's also a mom. In 2012, she touched a chord with her Atlantic magazine article, Why Women Still Can't Have It All. In it, she voiced her frustration with the reality of work-life-family imbalance. A woman who seemingly had it all had called out basic flaws in the system for working mothers. She wrote, I was increasingly aware that the feminist beliefs on which I had built my entire career were shifting under my feet. Slaughter's views on what's wrong with our work ethic have evolved since her article was published, in large part, she says, due to the conversation it sparked. She argues that our work systems suppress talent in general. She says, that's not just a women's problem, but a work problem, an economic problem, and a moral problem. Slaughter's new book is Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family. She spoke at Town Hall Seattle on October 5th, 2015. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for our recording. Here, Town Hall's Ware Harmon introduces the talk.
To introduce Dr. Slaughter, I want to welcome to the stage Nicole Fizet-Resch. Ms. Resch is a global program lead at Microsoft and a member of the Washington Women's Foundation, our partner in tonight's program. Please welcome Nicole Fizet-Resch.
Hi, my name again is Nicole Fizet-Resch, and I am a member of the Washington Women's Foundation. We're proud to co-present tonight's program with Town Hall, and we're also very pleased to be able to tell you a little bit about the Washington Women's Foundation. We are a group of just over 500 women who pool our resources and collectively grant large impact grants to local nonprofit organizations. And actually, fun fact, in 2003, Town Hall was the recipient of our Arts and Culture Grant, which helped to upgrade the room that you're sitting in right now. So I joined the foundation in 2013 because one day I'd like to run a foundation, and I wanted to learn everything I possibly could about how grant making is done. And I wanted to learn by actually doing. And I did get the experience of a full grant cycle in my first year with the foundation. But what was interesting is what I learned over and above the grant making. I sat around that table and weighed grant making decisions as an equal with women who had run corporations, run foundations, had raised their children and sent them off to college, had lived for decades outside of the U.S., and a dozen other experiences that I wanted to learn from. And I'm not sure where else I could get that kind of exposure. So access to that diverse community of 500 women is the main reason that I continue to be part of the community. So if that sounded appealing, we would love to have you join us. We are open to all women for membership, and if you want to know a little bit more about how it works, we have a table out in the lobby, and I welcome you to join us. So on to tonight's program with Anne-Marie Slaughter. Dr. Slaughter is the president and CEO of New America, which is a think tank and civic enterprise with offices in Washington, D.C. and New York. She's also the Bert G. Kurtzsetter University Professor Emerita of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University. From 2009 to 2011, Dr. Slaughter served as Director of Policy Planning for the United States Department of State. She was the first woman to hold that position. When she left the State Department, Dr. Slaughter received the Secretary's Distinguished Service Award for her work leading the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review. And prior to her government service, Dr. Slaughter was the Dean of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, and the J. Sinclair Armstrong Professor of International, Foreign, and Comparative Law at Harvard Law School. Dr. Slaughter has written or edited 6 books, and in 2012, she published the article, Why Women Still Can't Have It All, in The Atlantic. That became one of the magazine's, actually the most read article in the magazine's history, and it spawned a renewed national debate on the continued obstacles to genuine full male-female equality. She joins us tonight to discuss her newest book, Unfinished Business. Please join me in welcoming to the stage Dr. Anne-Marie Slaughter.
Thank you. What a splendid space. This is gorgeous. So I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to talk to you about a book that I could not have written 3 years ago when I published my article. I published the article, as you heard. It ignited a great deal of debate. I was actually in Scotland when it went up online on a Wednesday with my kids and my husband. We were as kind of a busman's holiday where we were giving speeches and seeing something of Scotland in this at the same time. And we flew back on Friday and we landed and I looked at the New York Times and there was an article with me and Sheryl Sandberg and 400,000 people had already downloaded the article. And my mother called up and said, "What have you done?" So the article, I occupied a lot of time that summer. The remainder of the year, I signed a book contract, and I've spent the last 3 years, first of all, just reading the hundreds of emails that I got, the comments online, having conversations with audiences like this one where I would give a speech and then we would have a back and forth, constantly thinking and then revising my thinking, and actually looking at my own family differently as well. One of the things that happened after my article came out was one of my close friends growing up, I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia in the 60s and early 70s, one of my close friends wrote and said, "You know, your dad was always really progressive. You know, like, my dad didn't raise me to have a career, but your dad always wanted you to have a career." And that hadn't occurred to me. I mean, yes, Dad had always wanted me to have a career, but I hadn't thought about why for a man in Virginia in the 60s. And so I asked him, and he explained that that was sort of the early or the first wave of what became a major wave of divorces that was partly the women's movement and partly the pill and partly lots of other things. And he represented, as a lawyer, a number of women whose husbands had left them, and they had put their husbands through school and they had raised the kids, and then they really were left with no means of supporting themselves. And my father said, at that point in the 60s, with a daughter, "My daughter is always going to be able to support herself." And I tell that story because I would have told you my dad was a lawyer and he was a great father, but I came to see his determination as a father to raise me the way he did as important as his work as a lawyer. And my mother, who was an artist and a homemaker, I came increasingly to see that those two sides of her were actually equal. I've always been proud of the art that her paintings, but I would have quickly told you my mother's an artist. I probably wouldn't have told you so quickly she was a homemaker. And over time, talking to her, talking to them, looking at our family, that sort of started to shift as well. And then, you know, I wrote about going home from the State Department, and I wrote about our eldest son, who didn't go through anything so extraordinary, for those of you who've been parents of teenagers, but I would say he had an acute case of teenage-itis. And, you know, I went home, and 2 years later, he was doing fine and is just started at university this year. But because of this article, I spent more and more time on the road. And I occasionally felt like this book should be written by the hypocrite in chief, because there I am, you know, talking to people, writing. I'm home, but I'm not home a lot. And my husband increasingly became what he had been in Washington, which was the lead parent. He was the parent at home. He has a full-time job, but it's a flexible job as a professor. And he, as both boys went through high school, he was the one who, you know, was there for the homework and there for the kind of getting them to do all the various things they've got to do, from music lessons to SATs. I was actively engaged, but he really was. I had to come to recognize, even when I was home, he was the lead parent. So all of that, and a lot of reading and a lot of thinking, gave rise to this book. And I want to start by the puzzle that I was confronted with, which is essentially 50 years after the second wave of the women's movement, we have transformed many women's lives and girls' lives. And that movement has been coterminous with my lifetime. And there's no question that I have had extraordinary opportunities that my mother did not have. If she wanted to be a doctor, she was told, you know, why? You're going to get married. There's no point in your going to medical school. And I was told growing up, when I went out and played tennis with a boy, don't lose your head and win. You know, competitive females couldn't get husbands. I actually got two. But we've had all this change, and now girls are outpacing boys. And believe me, I know this. I'm the mother of two teenage boys, and girls are doing better in high school, better in college. In fact, when my elder son and I went and looked at colleges, we were essentially told that his GPA and scores could be lower than if he had been a girl, because the competition is tougher for girls. And they're, you know, colleges still want to have a roughly even balance, so a little thumb on the scale for a lot of boys. They're doing better in college. They're doing better in graduate school. There are more of them in graduate school. They're coming out, and they're earning equal salaries with men in many professions, and equal numbers. And then as you head toward the prime of people's careers, toward the top-level jobs, there is this great falling off. Right? In a good industry, we have maybe 20% women, maybe. And in many industries, including the technology industries, you're looking more at 5% in the top ranks. Essentially, what's happening is as women have children or are taking care of their own parents or spouse, as caregiving obligations become a big part of life, women are falling out of the tracks that they have been on. And so the question is, you know, how do we get past that? We've been pretty much stuck there since the early 1990s. One of the things people pointed out to me when I wrote my article was, wait a minute, that article got written in 1990 and it got written in 2000 and you're writing it in 2012. We're not breaking through. That's the way we normally think about this problem, or certainly the way I did. Why don't we have anything that looks like 50-50 women politicians, women CEOs, women tenured professors, whatever your metric is? And that's important. But I came to think we're not looking at the whole picture. Because when we think about women's advancement, we think about things we can count. Like the Fortune 500, it's easy to know. How many women are in the Fortune 500? Answer, 29. You look at women at the top and you can measure the progress. But what we're not looking at is the number of women at the bottom. Because I write in the book that there's an unlovely symmetry. There are too few women at the top, but there are vastly too many women at the bottom. The majority of minimum wage workers are women. Two-thirds of shift workers are women. The poorest members of our society are single mothers who are simultaneously supporting their families and providing as much care as they can. So that was the sort of first shift in my own thinking, was realizing, wait a minute, we have to look at the condition of all women, which the women's movement has long tried to do. But the experience of white upper middle class women still dominates how we think about it. And we're not seeing this too few women at the top and too many women at the bottom. So then looking at that, and I'll come back to this, I started thinking about, you know, what unified the experience of those women. And they're disparate in many ways, but one of the things that does unify them is that at the top and at the bottom, you're essentially suffering from discrimination against caregiving. If you're at the top and you take time out to be a mother, to be a daughter, to care for those you love, that is essentially a black hole on your resume. You are off leadership track. Even if you stay in, if you're working part-time, if you're working flexibly, you're no longer on leadership track. And if you step out completely, you as I said, you've got this big hole on your resume you have to explain. For women at the bottom, the consequences are far, far worse. But it's the same kind of discrimination or bias. It means that a woman who has a job, is providing for her family, if her child gets sick, and she has to stay home with that child. She doesn't have paid leave. She can lose her job. If there's a snow day, probably not so frequently in this part of the world, but in my part of the world, it snows and the schools close and the workplaces don't. And what are you supposed to do? I remember this as an early dean with, you know, a full day because the university never closes. And I had two children, 5 and 3, right? And I frantically called to every undergraduate woman I knew, and one of them had a working mother, and she knew the straits I was in, and she came and saved me. So in both cases, women are paying a penalty, yes, because they're women, but more because they're caregivers. Because if they didn't have those obligations, they would be able to compete differently. So that was the way I started to frame the problem. And then I started looking at these various half-truths that are holding us back. And I wrote about them in the article. I said, you know, it's a half-truth that if you're committed enough to your career, you can make it. That's sometimes true, but it's only part of the story. If you marry the right person, if you sequence your career, truth in all of those, but not fully true. But then think about some of the half-truths with respect to men, because these are holding us back too. So we say it's a man's job to provide. That's actually in the Bible. It's also in the Quran. It's this idea, it's a man's job to provide. And it is a man's job to provide for his family if he has a family. But it's my job to provide too. I'm the primary breadwinner in our family, and even if I weren't the primary breadwinner, we would need two incomes. I'm providing just as much as my husband is. And providing, why is providing only cash? Right? You can provide in lots of ways. If you are providing for your family, there's cash, and that's great, but it sits on the table and does nothing except for someone's work, turning it into food and shelter and clothing, and more importantly, nurture and discipline and moral instruction and nagging and all the things that go into raising children, or for that matter, taking care of elders. The other thing we say is a child needs her mother or his mother. And I have a driver who drives a taxi, takes me back and forth to the train station, and he would often say this to me, you know, and he would mean it as a compliment. You know, he would mean it as, you know, a child needs its mother. A child, there's something special about mother love. I do think a child needs his or her mother. But I think a child equally needs his or her father, and frankly, as many adults in that child's life who can provide stability and love and support. And this sort of way we have, so when we say that, what we're saying is, you know, it's the mother's primary job to raise a child, and a child can't be raised properly without a mother, which is, to begin with, very unfair to many single fathers and many men who have very successfully raised their kids. Finally, just one of these half-truths in the workplace, and I have a number of other ones in the book. In the workplace, we say flexibility is the solution. And I wrote that in 2012. And in my own life as a professor, flexibility was essential. And I said I didn't realize how essential until I went to Washington and worked in a large bureaucracy like many other people and worked on other people's schedules. Flexibility is essential, but what we've got now is flexibility stigma. Right? So there is flexibility if you're fortunate enough to be in a workplace that has various flexible policies, and more do. But as I said before, if you take advantage of those policies, you are stigmatized. You are no longer on leadership track. You are no longer considered a player. And that is true for women, and it's even more true for men. Because if a man does that, if he takes paternity leave, if he works part-time, not only is he not committed to his career in the way women are looked at too, but his very masculinity is brought into question. Is he really one of the guys? And lots of men wrote to me about what that was like, arguing, wait a minute, you know, you're seeing this only through female lenses. This is also true for men. We just don't see it as often because fewer men take that role. So let me move forward to, I've laid out problems, to sort of how I now think about the solutions. And it comes essentially from, as I said, the things holding us, the way I've come to think about it, is we've made a halfway revolution. We have made enormous strides in the way that women, the options open to women, and certainly the way we raise girls. Now, let me just say right here, we are not all the way there by a long shot. I think what Sheryl Sandberg writes about in Lean In and subconscious bias is true. I think that women still do have a long way to go in terms of feeling fully confident. And I say openly that my husband taught me to act like a man. When we would be in seminars together, he would listen to me start an intervention, and I would typically say, well, I'm not an expert in this, but... And Andy would say to me, you just told everybody not to listen to you. You just told everybody you didn't know what you were talking about. Why would they listen to you if you start that way? I believe in all of that, but I still think we have made enormous progress. But there are two things that we left behind. One is we've said women have all these options, but essentially they have the options to be breadwinners. They have options to do the work their fathers did. Men and women, we say, are equal. But the women's work, the traditional work of caregiving, without which human society cannot survive, and frankly, without which we do not invest in the next generation of citizens, that work of caregiving is still way below the traditional men's work of breadwinning. So you can't say men and women are equal, but they each had this sphere of work, and those are unequal. That doesn't work. And the second thing is, we have changed women's roles enormously, but as I looked at my sons, I realized if they were daughters, I'd be raising them completely differently than my mother was raised. But as sons, I'm not raising them all that differently than my father was raised. And I say, that's me. I'm a strong feminist. I still realize essentially the messages all boys get are the messages my father's got and my brother's got, which is, your worth as a man is determined by how good a breadwinner you are, how much money you bring home, how high you rise in your career, how good you are in that professional sphere of bringing home an income. And you can't have that halfway either. You cannot change women's roles and not change men's roles. You get a halfway revolution. You get an imbalance that we see as the imbalance in any one working mother's life, and we call it the work-life balance. No, the imbalance is a much, much bigger. It's imbalance in the way we value care versus the way we value earning an income. And again, they're two basic human drives, and they're equally necessary for human survival. And we have an imbalance because we've changed the roles of women, but we haven't changed the roles of men. And just to give you a very concrete example, if you look at the Fortune 500 or any gathering of CEOs, of male CEOs, there is not a single male CEO out there who is also a lead parent or a primary caregiver. In fact, the very idea seems preposterous. I mean, how could you be the CEO of a large company and flying around the world and being in all your meetings and be available when your kid's teacher calls or there's a snow day, or my favorite example with my sons is always 6 p.m. the night before suddenly your child says, oh, I have a project due. What kind of a project? Oh, well, we need poster board and magic markers and construction paper and, you know, how long have you known about this? Oh, 2 weeks. You know, all of that. Music lessons, all of that. No male CEO would ever be able to do what he does and do all of that. So clearly, if we're going to have an equal number of women CEOs, then the men in their lives, or the women, depending on who they are, somebody in their lives is going to have to play that role. So that's where we are, that this is a fundamental imbalance. It is unfinished business. And now we have to finish the business of the women's movement. So how do we do it? Well, I could say read the book and open it up to questions, but I'll tell you a few things. Essentially, first, I think you frame it this way. You understand that this is not a women's problem. This is a work problem, it's a couple's problem, and it is absolutely a national problem. It's a work problem because we've got a workplace that is locked in the 1950s that still assumes workers have somebody providing care full-time at home. And that's just not true, right? 60% of American women are in the workforce and 70% of American mothers. So we have to look at the workforce and say, look, we need a workforce that makes room for care. We need a workplace that makes room for care. Not that gives special policies for women, but that makes room for care. And again, that care can be your children, or I was born in 1958, which is the height of the baby boom. That means as I age, the baby boom becomes an elder boom. You can choose whether or not you have children, but you can't choose whether or not you have parents. And you can choose to like them, but they're your parents, and you know some large number of us, and I will be on the needing care, but people have to take care of their parents. Our children will have to. And so we need to think about it as making room for care, because now you've got a workplace where you've got breadwinners and caregivers both, just as you have a home where you have breadwinners and caregivers both. It's a couple's problem because couples really have to think about hard how they're going to make room for care. And I have a part of the book that has a conversation that I think all young people should have with one another when they set out. And it's got to be more than, do you support my career? Because everybody says yes. But that is not the question. The question is, one question, I have a lot of them, if I get a promotion, will you move for me? That's when things get tough, right? That's when one of you has a chance to advance, and if we are going to tap the tremendous female talent in this country, there's got to be a lot of those women who get that promotion. Often those promotions require you to move or require you to travel a lot, and then the other person has to be that lead parent. So couples have got to think about this. I actually think that couples should approach these questions the way same-sex couples do. I think same-sex couples are actually in the lead here, because if you have two men or two women, when they try to figure out how to divide this up, there's no natural default role, natural in quotes. There's no, I'm the woman, so I'm the natural caregiver, you're the man, so you're the natural breadwinner. It's who makes the most money? That's a big question. Who has the best boss? Who has the most flexible career? Who wants to do what, right? In my case, my husband and I, you know, we both hold down full-time jobs. He would say, and he just wrote an article called Why I Put My Wife's Career First, he'd say, I'm just more ambitious than he is. He's plenty ambitious by many people's standards, but the point is every human being's different, and it shouldn't be a gendered matter. So it's a couple's problem, and then it is an enormous national problem. I'll come back to sort of what we have to do, but we really, this is a matter for, in the first place, the next generation. And we now know that the first 5 years of children's lives, you're not just teaching them stuff. You are shaping their brains, and you're determining what they'll be able to learn for the rest of their lives. In other words, we bake in the achievement gap in those first 5 years if we don't provide the kind of quality care that we now know children need in those years. And it's also a competitiveness problem because we're losing so much of our talent. Okay, so what do we do? So first of all, we think about it this way, as a care problem, as a problem of not making room for care, and as a problem of not opening up roles for men in the same way that we've opened up roles for women. And let me say one more thing on that. I wouldn't have believed that if a number of men had not written to me and said, you think I have it all, but I would much rather spend more time with my children. I would much rather be able to balance my work with my family at this phase of my life, but I don't have that choice. I'm supposed to be the breadwinner, and I don't have those options. I think there are many men out there, if we can loosen gender roles for men the way we have for women, we will find many men, not that they don't want to be providers, but that they are very willing to have much more room in their lives for care. And indeed, we know that when men look back at the end of their lives, their top regret is, I didn't lead the life I wanted, but the life society expected of me. And the second topmost regret is I didn't spend enough time with my family. So I think we can loosen this up. So what do? We think about it differently. We change how we talk. You notice I don't say stay-at-home mom or stay-at-home dad. That implies that the natural state of being is in the office. And if you're not in the office, you need an adjective, which is weird. I talk about lead parents because that's really what I think somebody's doing. They're taking the lead on the parenting side or the caregiving side if you're taking care of your own parents. But somebody, as I said, has to be the flexible, available one. We could talk about working fathers. We constantly talk about working mothers. And A, that again says it's a mother's job to raise a child, to raise the family. And if she's not doing that, we need an adjective that says she's working and doing that. Why don't we talk about working fathers? Why don't we constantly remind ourselves that men have two roles just as women have two roles? And the last one, I have a number of others in the book, but the last one I'll talk about here is let's get rid of the verb help at home. My husband helped. My husband's helping. And let's absolutely get rid of my husband's babysitting. That one is just... You don't babysit your own children. But even the helping, because this has gotten a lot of attention. We need men to help more. We need men to step up more. Helping means you made the list, and you are now making sure he's doing everything on the list your way. And that's not going to work either, right? If you're really going to let him be equal, much less be lead parent, you've got to let him have an equal say in how things are run at home, just as you expect to have an equal say in the office. This, and I will tell you, this is where things get very difficult for many women, right? This is tough. And I went through it with my own husband, and I actually heard Gro Harlem Brundtland, the first woman prime minister in Norway, say that this had happened with her and her husband. Both of them said, I'll do it, but I'm doing it my way. And that often is a very different way than you would do it. But who are we to say our way is right? When a man says, I know how to do things in the office because I'm a man and because men have always been in the office, I say, uh-uh, that's not good enough. And so how is it that we as women are so sure we know the right way to do things at home? You've got to lose, you just can't have it both ways. So let's get rid of helping. Then let's think about how to plan careers. Most young people will have many different jobs. I've actually changed jobs almost every 8 years, even in my generation, and certainly you look at younger people and their, you know, 4-year jobs, 3-year jobs, and all the work on the future of work says they're going to have lots of different jobs, different companies working for themselves. So why not think about our careers in terms of interval training? Just like you, if you're an athlete and you're getting into peak condition, you go really hard and then you slow down. And then you go really hard again and you slow down. That's how you actually get into peak condition. Why not think about our careers the same way? Instead of sort of climbing a ladder or any kind of sort of direct ascent, let's think about it as, there are periods where you really can work very hard to try to get something accomplished. When I got tenure, when I became a dean, when I went into government, those were all periods where I had to be absolutely focused on my work. I had to lean in. I had to do all of that. And then there are other periods when you're trying to have children, when your children are young, when your children are teenagers, when your parents are really aging, where it's less important to go hard at work and more important to have time for care. And why shouldn't we think about our careers in those terms, men as well as women? Why shouldn't men and women be able to, say, each work half-time or 3/4 time during those periods, particularly when they have young children or, again, teenagers? And why shouldn't we have phase 3, right? When our kids go to college, if we have kids or are otherwise out of the house, why then many women, Hillary will be 70 if she wins, and Janet Yellen is 67, and Madeleine Albright, who I gather was here recently, basically had most of her really high-powered career after her kids left. Why don't we think about that whole second surge at that interval post-caregiving? And then in the workplace, there are so many changes. Instead of thinking about it as flexible work, and certainly not flexible work for women, we should be thinking about how to reinvent the workplace. We are reinventing our economy. Certainly in this town, you are reinventing your economy. There is no reason to think about being tethered to an office in the way you had to, where the office was the only place you could get work done. And I run an organization. It's not that I think everybody should be at home and work from wherever, although there are organizations that make that work. But I definitely think that what matters is the work that gets done, not where someone was sitting and how long they showed their face in the office, as long as the work is done of a high quality, on time, and the work that I actually need done. And every workplace is probably going to strike a different balance. There's a place called OpenWork, openwork.org, that is exactly that. It's let's overcome the poverty of imagination about the way we work. And it has all sorts of different companies that are doing this, and they range from construction companies to telemarketers to sales to every different kind of industry. So I don't think there's going to be sort of one size fits all here, but I do think we should be thinking about it as reinventing the workplace and getting rid of flexibility stigma and coming together and asking how do we work differently and how do we work better. And finally, we do have to do this together. There are things that we can do individually, and I've talked about that. In the end, though, we're not going to finish the business of the women's movement unless, as citizens, at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level, we come together and say, look, we actually have to create a national infrastructure of care. We have to have paid leave. It's completely insane that somebody could lose their job or their livelihood if somebody gets sick or have that, some kind of other catastrophe. We need maternity leave. We're one of three countries or nine countries, depending on which survey you look at, in the whole world that doesn't have paid maternity leave. We're up there with Papua New Guinea and Lesotho and Swaziland. And, we have to have paternity as well as maternity leave. A number of European countries are now having use it or lose it paternity leave, meaning if the men don't take it, they just lose it. They can't give it to their wives. In Finland, I talked to a Finnish CEO who said to me that since they've done that, his company starts to look at men who didn't take their paternity leave and worry about their character. Because I think part of that's just like, how stupid are you? Why are you leaving money on the table? But I also think he's saying, you know, people have started to think, these are your children. What's the matter with you that you wouldn't take 2 months to bond with them? And that's the kind of culture change that can really make a difference. So we need maternity and paternity leave, and we need a variety of ways to create enormous incentives for quality childcare, affordable quality childcare that can be on site, that can be community based. There are many different ways to do it. In 1971, a bill passed both houses of Congress on a bipartisan basis for universal childcare, and Richard Nixon vetoed it. We can get back there. We really can. It's just a question, again, of not being a women's issue, but being a citizen's issue. And on paid leave, I think it's going to come from cities. Cincinnati passed it over the weekend. I live in New Jersey. We have paid leave off a payroll tax. The Secretary of Labor is now studying about 10 cities around the country on how these different policies are going to happen. I think it'll be cities and then states and then federal. But ultimately, we do have to do some of this together. So let me leave you with this thought. You know, a lot of us moan about trying to fit our families and our work together, but I can tell you that there were plenty of days when I was a professor and I was lucky enough, I was a dean, but I was lucky enough to live about a mile from where our house and our work and the kids' schools were all about within a mile. And there would be whole weeks where, you know, as a dean, a child's ear infection would just like knock down a set of appointments, just like dominoes. I mean, it would all fall down. But there were many other days where I would think, I am just the luckiest human being in the world. I have, you know, a family I love and work I love, and it just doesn't get any better. And my proposition is that with these changes, with the idea that this is all of our problem, it's a work problem, it's men and women's problem, it's a national problem, we can actually put in place the changes in our personal lives and in our work lives and nationally that make that wonderful opportunity to have both available to everybody, to rich women and to poor women, to middle-class women and to women and to men. And that is finishing the business of the women's movement. Thank you. Thank you. The floor is open.
So, if we could have everyone queue up that would like to ask questions, please keep your questions concise and in the form of a question, and we'll begin now. Thank you.
Hi. You framed this as a work problem, as well as others. And I'm wondering if you can reflect a little bit about what you're seeing across the U.S. in terms of what might give you hope. We're here in Seattle. We've got a lot of high-tech companies, some that were recently written up in the New York Times, for how not progressive and forward-thinking they are in terms of valuing caregiving. And I don't think it's just high-tech, though. That's certainly an issue here in Seattle. But it's other industries as well that champion themselves as innovative and forward-thinking, that you know you have to be fully committed to them in every aspect.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering just what your experience has been in seeing those kind of companies and other companies and how much they are on the trajectory to value caregiving.
Yeah, thanks. So let's start on the high end. And yes, I'm aware that this does not apply to all tech companies. There are, at the sort of the same time there was that New York Times article, there have been other articles that Netflix and a couple of the other big tech companies are offering now up to a year of leave for women and for men. And I take that as a positive sign for two reasons. One, it's the beginning of culture change, right? So you're seeing men take it, which is important. But two, there's a very tight market there. And so what those companies are recognizing is to attract the talent they want, this is what they have to do, which tells you that this is very important to millennials who have choices, to the people they're trying to attract. So there's positive signs there. I think more broadly, I'll take law. It's the world that I know best. I was a law professor for 12 years. Big law firms are in trouble for all sorts of reasons, and this is not the only. But one of them is they hemorrhage female talent, right? They train these associates and they get close to partner, and then they have this completely stupid business model that assumes quantity matters more than quality, the billable hour. Which, by the way, we didn't have until the 70s. There's nothing that says lawyers have to work that way. And the whole business model is coming undone. And so what you're starting to see are, virtual law firms that allow people to work on a project basis, all sorts of ways that are kind of deconstructing the way we've traditionally practiced law. So I find that to be also encouraging. And then, as I said, on the open work, what you're seeing are lots of companies that are really experimenting with everything from, frequent flyer miles, the equivalent of for every hour you work and giving you different kinds of leave and incentives, to more sort of traditional HR kinds of policies. I'm hopeful. Because I think, again, this is about talent. This is about keeping talent and retaining it. It's very expensive to lose it, and not only because you have to train somebody else, but because you've lost somebody who's really good. I do think, though, that unless you have federal government standards, the bad companies drive out the good, right? I mean, because the companies that are doing what I consider to be the right thing can get undercut. So I'm encouraged, but this is where I push very hard on national policy or municipal or state at the same time. Yes.
Thanks so much for doing this. excuse me. I'm wondering about root causes and intersectionality and kind of why your argument stops where it does. You spoke about how masculinity tends to be valued on capital, right? Valued on earnings potential. But that seems to me to be more of an indictment of capitalism, of neoliberalism, I mean, a gendered indictment, but an indictment of a larger system than it is of a gender binary per se. Hmm. And furthermore, it seems to me to focus on the binary per se and the women's movement per se throws into question how these solutions interact with other movements, most specifically trans rights, because trans rights is, I would argue, all about fighting against this simple kind of gender binary. And so I'm curious why the arguments stop where they do and kind of how they interact with these larger questions. Hmm.
So it's a good question, although I thought this was big enough. But two things. On intersectionality, this is a effort to get back to what the early women's movement aspired to. It never lived up to it totally, because it was always more about white, middle-class, suburban women than it was all women, and certainly women of color were left out. But if you go back to Gloria Steinem's speeches, this is the 60s. This is social revolution, right? And she's talking about this, you know, our revolution for women is part of the civil rights movement. It is part of the anti-establishment movement, attacking capitalism in various ways, but more essentially saying, look, we want liberty, we want freedom to live as we want, and we want equal rights for everybody. And part of, I draw on that work a little bit. I do think that as I said, one of the things I like most about the framework of care is that it's far more all-encompassing than the framework of just advancing women. So that was a very deliberately chosen intersectionality. On the question of the binary, so I don't disagree with you. I did not talk about the trans movement, but I talk a lot about, as I said, single-sex couples and the ways in which I think that actually has a better way of looking at people in terms of their personalities and who they are and not their gender. And you could certainly take it farther and just say, look, what is going on here is to really free up one gender, you have to free up the other, and then you're going to end up accepting anything in between.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So you spent most of your talk talking about, you know, your personal choices, the couple choices, and clearly that's the first the place to start, and that's very important. But really the issue, as you said, is what you find when you go to the workplace and you say, well, this is what I decided to do, and your boss is not with it. And your boss tends to be a white man, you know, for whom all your arguments, he's not even going to be aware of them. It's not the guy that has read your book or is even thinking about that stuff. And how can we get to them? Because they are really, that's the obstacle that you're facing.
Yep. So that's funny. I posted something on LinkedIn this weekend that said, how to have the conversation with your boss. So there are a couple of things that I think you can do, even with very resistant bosses. And the starting point is that this is not about accommodating your needs as a woman. This is about how you can do a better job. And you can do a better job for this person. That's the way you frame it. And this is no deception. I believe you'll be able to do a better job if you can work from home one day a week, or if you can leave, you know, at 5 and then get back online at 7. Whatever it is that would make a difference, what you say is, I could do a better job if I could do this because it will allow me to, you know, take care of what I need to take care of, and then I can be completely focused on the job. Or if you're working at home, I'll be able to work on longer-term projects. I'll be able to get my writing done, whatever it is. And then you do it on an experimental basis. You say, you know, let's try this for a couple of months. If it doesn't work, I'm perfectly happy to reconsider. That's an approach that has worked. I've got various examples. And again, it says, look, I want to do the best job I can, and I'm trying to figure out how to do that. But the second thing you do is you make common cause with the men in your office who are also, look, 56% of women report that it's hard or very hard to combine work and family. 50% of men do, Right? There are plenty of guys out there that are finding this difficult. And my proposition is, again, you get together with a bunch of your colleagues, not just women, women and men, and you talk about how could we make this office work better for all of us? How could we be more efficient? How could we, you know, in some cases, actually, you know, the big corporations are finding that letting people work from home cuts down on real estate costs. There are lots of ways. But that's, I agree with you that I've experienced it myself and I've seen it where you get that kind of resistance. But I think you can tackle it from a different perspective that is much harder to turn down if the proposition is I'm getting better work done.
So it has to come from the bottom, not.
Well, it should come from both, right? But what I have seen in my own workplaces and also the research shows. It's got to come from the top down, but even when, you know, the boss is very supportive, you still get this middle level of managers who are often very resistant. So, yes, it does have to come from the top down, and there are all sorts of ways you can build in incentives, but I think it also has to come from the bottom up, speaking the language that person understands, which is not, you need to accommodate my caregiving, it's, I can do a better job for you.
That's it for this broadcast of Speakers Forum. You can hear a full podcast of this talk by Anne Marie Slaughter on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Slaughter spoke at Town Hall Seattle on October 5th, 2015. Thanks again to Anna Tatashev for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum. Good night.